the moment they see gold, everyone kind of just melts and goes a little crazy. That metallic luster, that shine, that sparkle, it always captivates people.
Welcome to Unearthed. My name is John Reed, and I'm here with my colleague and co-host, Joe Cavatoni. We're talking today about central banks. This is a topic that we've had so much interest and speculation about. And the main question, really, why are central banks buying so much gold? What does this mean for gold demand overall? And what does it say about the global topics of economics, geopolitics, etc.?
Our guest today is Xiaokai Fan, head of Asia Pacific for the World Gold Council and the global head of central banks. Thanks for joining us today, Xiaokai.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, John. Good to be here.
So let's set the scene. Central banks became buyers of gold after the global financial crisis in about 2010, net buyers of gold. Before that, they were net sellers for about 20 some odd years. So what's really brought about this sustained change, this 13-year trend, and why now are central banks continuing to stock up on gold?
Joe, that's a great question. You know, I think that central banks in 2008, 2009 or so, right around the global financial crisis, were confronted with a brand new set of dynamics that they hadn't had to think about for many decades, certainly since the end of Bretton Woods in the early 70s. A lot of that was the beginning of quantitative easing in the U.S., which was really unconventional monetary policy back then. You know, now, you know, sitting over a decade later, we're all used to that. But that was something new. And I think it made a lot of central banks, especially emerging market central banks, think about all the huge holdings of dollars that they had and what will happen to that when the Federal Reserve starts essentially printing a lot more of it. So I think at that point, it made some central banks turn around and say, hey, well, what can we do besides hold dollars and hold treasuries? What else is out there? And honestly, from a central bank perspective, there's actually not that much else out there if you need to diversify. There's, you know, the euro and the German Bund market. There's the Japanese yen. There was, at the time, the up-and-coming RMB market. And then there's gold, which is something that they've known for, you know, 4 or 5 centuries since there have been central banks. So I think a lot of them turned to gold then as a result. And for the last 13, 14 years or so, they've been buying. But of course, things have changed. There are new dynamics at play, which I'm sure we'll talk about throughout the course of today.
We asked Xiaokai to elaborate on the impact of Bretton Woods.
Well, Joe, you know, Bretton Woods is a little mountain town in New Hampshire. Picturesque little mountainside resort. Drive up I-95 from New York. You'll get there in a couple hours. What's important is what happened there in 1944. As the Second World War was winding down, the Allied powers met there to decide what the post-war international financial system would look like and how they would configure the system to help with post-war reconstruction and also essentially to make sure that that type of catastrophe could not happen again, at least from a financial perspective. What they decided on afterwards was that gold would still be at the very center of the international monetary system, but currencies would not be pegged to gold directly. Instead, only the US dollar would be pegged to gold. And that's because the US, of course, was not severely damaged from the war. A lot of gold ended up in the US for safekeeping. The dollar was going to be now the center of the financial system, pegged to gold, exchanged at $35 per ounce. And then all the other currencies around the world under the Bretton Woods system would then be pegged to the dollar. But over the course of the 50s and 60s, the Bretton Woods system became increasingly unsustainable, largely because of large deficits run by the U.S. because of the Vietnam War, the very quick recovery of Germany and Japan after World War II. Basically, by the early 1970s, Bretton Woods was not looking like it could be maintained. And in 1971, President Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard, essentially suspending Bretton Woods by saying that the dollar was no longer convertible to gold. And basically, since the early 70s, we've gone off the Bretton Woods system. And now the value of currencies are now no longer pegged to gold or any other object. They're determined by supply and demand, or, you know, in the case of a restricted currency, by government fiat. But in general, currencies' values are determined by supply and demand against each other and no longer pegged to gold.
Before we go on to what's happening today, though, you've spoken about why central banks started to buy gold, but there's obviously another element to that as well. The sellers who sold in the 20-odd years up until the global financial crisis stopped selling. What do you think was behind that?
Well, I think the sellers up to that point were mostly Western central banks, mainly Western European central banks. They had accumulated large stocks of gold reserves because of the Bretton Woods system, the previous financial system that we had. And for many decades after the end of Bretton Woods, with gold no longer being a formal part of the international financial system, the central banks thought, you know, well, why keep all this gold? Why not start selling it? There were various agreements signed starting in the late 90s that tried to regulate the sales of gold from central banks. But I think ultimately what changed was 2008. And for the same reason that EM central banks had to start thinking hard about diversification, the Western central banks, having so much gold, thought, well, wait a second, we have all this gold. Let's not get rid of it too quickly. Let's not be too hasty. And maybe let's stop selling and hold on to it for a while because we don't really know what's going to come around the corner at this point.
So is this shift a shift from developed market central banks to emerging to developing market central banks? Or are we continuing to see some developed market central banks in the market for gold?
There are some developed or advanced economy central banks buying gold, but you're right. It's largely a phenomenon of the developed market central banks no longer selling gold and the emerging market central banks starting to buy large amounts of gold. The couple of exceptions are Ireland. The Central Bank of Ireland has bought some gold in the last few years. Singapore has bought quite a bit of gold in the last 2 years or so, but Singapore actually had very little gold reserves. It only graduated to developed market in the last couple of decades. You know, they have a lot of room to add more gold.
So central banks have been relatively steadily buying gold since the global financial crisis, but the pace of those purchases really stepped up last year. What do you think's going on there?
You're right, John. It's been off the charts. Last year was the highest year of central bank gold buying ever in 2022. And then the first half of this year has been the strongest first half for central bank buying. You know, there are a lot of things happening in the world right now. I think it's impossible to pinpoint just one reason that central banks are buying so much gold. But certainly the geopolitical environment and the risk environment overall, I think, has led many central banks to think about ways to diversify their assets. We all know about the terrible situation in Ukraine. After the invasion by Russia, the Western powers put sanctions on the Central Bank of Russia's foreign currency reserves, effectively freezing them. The ones that were held overseas. But the Russian central bank has a lot of gold, and all of that gold is held domestically in Russia. And I think that that action was a bit of a wake-up call to some central banks. Maybe they didn't think that their foreign exchange reserves could be frozen or sanctioned, but now we know that that's a possibility. So I think that that geopolitical uncertainty has definitely been an element in why central banks have been turning to gold a lot more recently.
Okay, can we unpack that a little bit more? We have a lot of interaction with institutional investors or organizations that are transacting in the retail markets. And we understand a lot about the thinking that goes on with those investment decisions, the analysis that plays into making an allocation to gold. We have data that supports that 2-5% allocation that comes about. I think the audience would benefit from understanding the objectives and the policy goals of central banks and how they kind of go through this decision process. You know, you bring up geopolitical risk, really challenging topic to measure and weigh into an investment decision. So how does a central bank start? How do they kind of go about thinking it through? What's the timeline for their decision process? Help us understand that process that they go through.
Yeah, I think that would be a great way to maybe run through the decision-making process of a central bank. If you think about why they hold these official reserves, so not just gold, but all their FX reserves overall, there's a variety of reasons. For a lot of emerging market central banks, it's to be able to intervene or stabilize their currency during periods of market instability. It's also sort of a large deterrent. If you have a big pot of reserves, it means that, you know, you're less vulnerable to a speculative attack, for instance. Some hedge fund manager out there can't go in and start shorting your currency because he or she feels like it. You have these defenses. It also means that you have a means to be able to step in if there's just unorderly markets in general, if there's a domestic financial instability in your country, for instance. These are all reasons why central banks hold these foreign exchange reserves. As to why they decide to hold gold and how much gold, I think then there's a lot of different reasons to start unpacking. First is just the total size of their reserves. You know, if they have a lot and it's growing, then they have the luxury of thinking, oh, maybe it's time to diversify. Maybe we should think about ways to protect against this risk or that risk. So I think that's one element of it, of course. The other element is they have to think about return and investment to a certain extent. But I think that for gold, they don't really look so much at return. They look at its ability to be a downside protection, this sort of safe haven aspect of gold being there when you need it. And one important aspect for central banks is that they're really investing for the rainy day, for sort of the really extreme scenario where they need to deploy their reserve assets to intervene in markets. And gold happens to be able to fit that profile really well. Gold generally does well when there's something wrong in the world. And when there's something wrong in the world, that might be when a central bank needs to intervene. Gold is very liquid, for instance, and a central bank might need to liquidate its gold holdings quickly and use that money to stabilize their markets. So for all those reasons, you know, gold makes a lot of sense for central banks. And then you talk about the geopolitical element of this too. And I think that, you know, can't be overlooked as well. Gold sends a signal, right? It's nobody else's liability. It isn't issued by any other country. So it's apolitical. It's politically neutral for that matter. So I think that holding gold means that, you know, you have a certain degree of independence, maybe, of demonstrating, whether it's to an international audience or sometimes a domestic audience, that your country has the ability to defend its currency and defend its markets when necessary.
So, Shaukai, central bank demand has slowed a bit in the second quarter of 2023. What should we be expecting? What are we watching for? What are the signals that are going to give us an indication that central banks are going to continue to buy and to what scale they'll be buying?
Joe, you're right. In Q2, we have seen a bit of a slowdown in central bank buying, but I'd say that that's largely attributable just to one large seller, which is the Central Bank of Turkey. Turkey had a presidential election a few months back. And when an election happens in Turkey, the Turkish people often go out and they buy large amounts of foreign currency and gold because of the instability that might happen in the Turkish lira around that election. And when coupled with the fact that in Turkey they had restrictions on importing gold, it meant that there was a big squeeze in the domestic gold market. So the Turkish Central Bank had to release some of its gold reserves into the domestic market to alleviate those liquidity constraints. So we don't think it's a strategic sale from the Turkish Central Bank. And in fact, now that this presidential election cycle has come and gone, the central bank has actually resumed buying as they have been doing for months, if not years, leading up to this as well. So when you actually take Turkey out, it was actually a very strong quarter, Q2, for central banks. We saw buying from China, from Singapore, from Poland, from India. And that just shows the widespread nature of central bank gold buying. It isn't confined to one geographic area. It isn't confined to one type of economy or one type of even, you know, currency regime, for instance. There's a lot of reasons that central banks are buying gold. And I think that for the remainder of this year, we'll look at things like, you know, who's been buying? Are we seeing new buyers emerge out there? Are we seeing more buying from the same countries, for instance? Is China going to continue this sort of monthly streak that we've been seeing now for the last 8 months or so? But overall, our view is that central banks will still be net buyers of gold for the remainder of the year as well.
One of the things I know that the central bank team at the World Gold Council do is conduct surveys of central bankers each year. You published the most recent survey of this a couple of months ago. What are the central bankers saying is the principal reason why they hold gold at the moment, Shaukai?
The most highly cited reason has been gold as an historical legacy asset, which has been somewhat consistent in the 5 or 6 years or so that we've been doing this survey. And, you know, that could be interpreted in different ways. It could be that they've always held gold and therefore they're just going to keep holding gold. Or it could be that they feel that gold has been around for a long time and it's always going to be around. Therefore, they hold it for that reason. But the second most cited reason has been gold's performance during times of crisis, which, you know, we were talking about just before. I think a lot of central banks do value that downside protection that gold can give during an unforeseen scenario. And more central banks, especially EM central banks, have been citing that reason as a major reason for why they buy gold.
So I guess that makes sense. If you think about the respondents to the survey, there's a mixture of developed markets and emerging market central banks. And obviously, the developed market central banks have had gold for a very long time. And I suspect that's probably the reason why they talk about legacy reasons for owning it. Other factors from your surveys over the past few years has really struck you, Sherpa? What stands out to you?
When we divide those results between the advanced and the emerging countries, that's where you really start to see a stark difference in how these two camps view gold. The advanced countries, like you say, they've held gold for decades, if not centuries, and they have a lot of it. So they always cite gold's legacy as a reason to hold gold. But the emerging market countries are much more focused on the active uses of gold. Gold is an active financial asset. So, you know, I talked about gold's performance during times of crisis, but there's also gold is good collateral, for instance, or, you know, because gold is a very liquid asset. Those are all reasons that are much more highly cited among the emerging market central banks, and probably why they've been buying a significant amount of gold in the last 15 years or so.
So, Xiaokai, when we talk with institutional investors, often what we're talking about is, what are you selling to generate cash to make your allocation to gold? How are you balancing out your portfolio? How are these central banks approaching this? Is this selling dollars? Is this selling other assets? What are they doing? And there's lots of talk around de-dollarization. Some thoughts on that would help the audience.
Sure. They might be selling dollars because gold, of course, is priced in dollars. A lot of the reason for buying gold has been just diversification. And the main thing to diversify away from is the US dollar. I think it makes sense that they're probably reducing some of their dollar holdings and buying gold with that. But that may not reflect a political decision to de-dollarize per se. Certainly, you know, Russia before the war, they stated that they had a de-dollarization policy. But I don't think that's the official stance of a lot of these central banks out there that are buying gold. You know, they might just want to diversify. And they happen to have a lot of dollars. That's the thing to diversify away from. That's not to say that, of course, you know, with the recent big uptick in gold buying, I do think there are political reasons behind it, geopolitical tensions. So de-dollarization is a factor. Our surveys show that it's a relevant factor, but usually toward the bottom of the pile in terms of relevance, and really just affects a handful of countries.
You raise a good point there, that something that I've thought about quite a lot over the years is the decision-making for a central bank to purchase gold, or indeed sell gold. Often I think that that's a decision that's taken right at the top of the organization, or maybe even above the central bank itself, something that comes down from politicians. Do you think that's a fair description, or is this just an asset which is considered as part of the normal mix that reserve managers consider?
When you read in financial news that central banks have been buying a lot of gold, that reminds you, hey, gold is an investable asset. Maybe I should think about buying gold because my central bank is buying gold. So I think from that perspective, it just reminds investors out there that gold is a useful asset and is an asset that's important. Other parallels include the fact that central banks are also fighting inflation. They're also considering what to do in a changing interest rate environment, and they've still turned to gold as a result. I don't think, you know, your average mom and pop investor is concerned about being sanctioned by a foreign government. So maybe that's not as much of an issue. But certainly that rising level of geopolitical risk and that rising level of uncertainty of our world being less predictable going forward is definitely an element that institutional and retail investors should think about. For central banks, they've turned to gold as a result. For institutional and retail investors, they might do the same.
And Joe, you speak to a lot of investors, as do I. What do you think this central bank's buying story has meant to investors?
I think it gives investors two key signals. Number one, they understand and they see that there's a level of activity on a global scale that keeps that price for gold in a healthy range. And I also think that they understand that these central banks are motivated by more than just geopolitical risks, that they're motivated by global concerns around the same kinds of concerns that these institutional investors are concerned about. So I think it sends a big signal to them that, hey, we need to think bigger about what we're doing. And that consideration for gold is definitely something on our mind. But I also think it signals to them that on that geopolitical risk issue, that the world's getting complicated. And I think that it ultimately reinforces in the back of their mind the complications that come along with geopolitical risks and the issues of systemic events or market events that would actually cause a shock to a portfolio. So I think it gives them two ongoing reminders and motivations and also some support around where the price might look and be in the next 6 to 12 months because of those strong purchases supporting the gold market. And it really kind of moves them in a direction to simply say, this asset does make more sense to me now. and I understand the broader applications and implications of having it in a portfolio. Mm. So it raises that level of awareness and the engagement level from the institutional side.
Yeah, I'd certainly echo that with the conversations that I've had. It's there's nothing like going to a country to talk about buying gold, and the central bank has just announced that it's added to its gold reserves. And that's happened to me on a couple of occasions over the last 12 months. It certainly dominates the conversation. I mean, in the end, central banks are some of the biggest asset owners in the world. When they're signaling that they want to buy gold and increase the rate of their purchases, I really do think that that's had a big impact.
Chalka, I'm going to switch gears just a little bit and ask about your views on central banks and their exploration around digital technology, whether it's their foray into a digital currency, some of this noise we hear around interest in cryptocurrencies. Does any of that come up in your dialogue? And how do the central banks interact with us or your team on the gold market as it relates to those topics?
It does. And, you know, we've had lots of conversations about those factors in our events with central banks as well. We sometimes even devote entire panels to talking about these things under the broad banner of technological change and innovation. Let's talk about digital currencies first, CBDCs. Central bank digital currencies have been talked about now for a number of years, and we've seen some test pilots in China, for instance, I think also in the Bahamas, the sand dollar. And certainly there are elements of a digitized or, I guess, programmable money that would make money smarter and would actually be really beneficial, not just for the central bank, but for society at large. That being said, I think a lot of central banks really rushed into this because they're all really keen on this very buzzy topic. But after some thinking, they thought to themselves, well, you know, do we really need to have a fully fledged CBDC? Maybe the existing financial infrastructure in our country actually does most of that with just a little bit of tweaking. You know, I was in a meeting a couple months back with essentially the finance minister of a country. We asked him about the CBDC projects happening in that country. And he said, you know, we looked into it, but we think our financial ecosystem is developed enough that a CBDC wouldn't add that much more value. That's not to say that things might not change. You know, certainly money is becoming more and more digital and electronic. We use much less cash these days. So that goes into it. And the way that we've talked about gold in that discussion is that some of the privacy aspects of CBDCs, for instance, is that going to prompt people to embrace them less and look for alternatives instead? That's been part of that conversation too. On the crypto side, yes, central banks do ask about that. No central bank that I know of has invested in a cryptocurrency as part of their official reserve assets. I think they're approaching it much more so from a regulatory point of view and needing to understand financial risks that might be brewing in their home markets, their domestic economies. They're curious about it, like we all are, but cryptocurrencies really don't fit the bill as a central bank reserve asset. Safety, liquidity, return, not quite there yet.
So when it comes to institutional dialogue with our clients, what we find is that there's definitely a level of interest, but it's a risk asset in their minds in many of these discussions. And there's a lot of work that still needs to be done before there's a real wholesale adoption or people moving into it in a large scale way, at least in the dialogue that we're having.
And I'd echo that. And certainly the collapse that we've seen in crypto funds and prices of various crypto assets over the last 12 months has certainly deterred, I think, a lot of institutional investors from the space, at least for the time being. So changing gear, and as a final question, Chalka, tell us an interesting fact about markets or gold or something that you've picked up in your travels that you think that investors won't know and might be interested in.
John, I'm going to jump in and answer that question first because I love giving people this fact about the gold market. Now, everyone knows that jewelry demand is substantial when it comes to the gold market. And one of the interesting facts that I love to remind people of is that gold is one of the most, if not the most, heat conductible metals that we know of. And that means that it is often preferred as a jewelry simply because it doesn't get cold or it doesn't get hot because it very quickly adapts to the body temperature of 98.6. And I think that's a cool fact. And actually, that fact is reminded to me by my wife on a regular basis.
That's very good, Joe. I like that.
This is not so much a fact, John, but something that I've noticed in the years that I've been working in the World Gold Council. When we take central bankers or anybody to a gold vault or to a refinery, and they actually hold a physical gold bar, you can see that they're mentally, intellectually curious about this. Even if when we talk to them in the meeting room and they say, I don't want to buy gold, I don't understand gold, the moment they see gold, everyone kind of just melts and goes a little crazy. That metallic luster, that shine, that sparkle, it always captivates people. It makes me happy to be able to share that because it's such an interesting product, I think, to let people hold and touch.
Yes, I've known CEOs of gold mining companies that when they've done their group investor presentations, have actually handed out gold bars to be passed around the room. I think as a way of subliminal advertising, there's few better techniques than that.
As long as they get it back at the end of being passed around.
Yeah, and I'd love to do it myself. I'd love to actually turn up at an investor meeting and pull out a kilo bar and pass it around. But I think getting that in and out of customs and borders might prove a little tricky in some jurisdictions.